Hey there, podcast listeners. This is AC Valdez, senior producer for Latino USA. Thanks for listening to us. I want to encourage you to check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. The latest episode explores what would happen if you could disappear fear, and it reveals the striking and rare case of a woman with no fear. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now, so you don't miss a single episode. And thanks for listening.
From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
As a kid, pretty much any character who wasn't a white guy, and even a lot of the white guys were stereotypes. At one point, there were more black boxers in fighting games than there were black main characters in every other video game.
Systems have orders and processes, but that doesn't always mean they're working. So we ask, what's up with the lack of diversity among video game characters? And a group reaching kids through the combination of computer programming and gardening?
So I was telling my brother about my project out here, and he was really excited for me because we were like the nerdy kids on the block, you know?
Plus the unintended consequences of the police slowdown in New York City. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we focus on gaming the system. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The gaming industry is hugely successful. Games like Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto V have made headlines over the last few years thanks to record-breaking sales. It makes sense when you consider that almost 60% of all Americans play video games. That's about 185 million people in the United States alone. It's clear that many people enjoy losing themselves while they play. But if you're Latino, it can be hard to find yourself in the games. About 3% of video game characters can be identified as Latino. People, that's 3%. And of that 3%, only 5% of those are characters that you can actually use to play. These very small numbers are according to a study published in the journal New Media and Society in 2009. Things are changing, though it isn't always easy. Last year's so-called Gamergate controversy showed just how resistant some gamers are to change, and also how much others want it. So, for today's show on Gaming the System, we bring you another in our four-part series on diversity in geekdom. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario has our story.
Video games for me, I started playing as a kid because, you know, they all came out around that time with Nintendo and Super Nintendo.
This is Mary Lourdes. She's a comedy writer and former co-host of the video game podcast Unlimited Lives. Mary loves games. She loves the sense of play and all the different ways that we use games.
When I'm on the subway and I just need to, like, kill a moment and, like, not think about anything, I could play, like, a phone game. Or I can play a game that I think about for, like, days because it's, like, a long adventure game that I'm, like, living in another world. Or I could go to a party and we'll, like, play, like, a karaoke game, you know? So it really is just something that's, like, become part of what I do and what I think about.
Even though Mary has loved games her whole life, she's still surprised by certain things.
I didn't realize how much I have a different experience from men when I play games and how much that shapes what I want to play.
Mary says she normally shies away from playing open format, large world games online because that means you'll have to interact with other online players. Given the option, she'll play a game offline and just follow the story. When the beta version of a new game called Destiny was released last year, Mary decided to try playing it online so she'd be ready to talk about it for her podcast. At first, it was great. She had really positive interactions with other players. That changed when her avatar started roaming around a marketplace area.
And this guy kept following me around because I was playing as a woman. And, like, he would make his character kneel so that his head was in my character's rear end.
Mary did not enjoy it. She says she's used to certain things. For example, playing online, everyone gets called names. Male, female, doesn't matter. That's something she knows and accepts.
But what I realized struck me the most is that I play games for the same reason that men do. I want to escape my reality. But even when I'm playing games, I can never escape the fact that I'm a woman. Like, I just can't get away from it. And it bums me out because it's like, we're all here for the same thing.
But being there for the same reasons doesn't mean everyone has the same experience.
It's the first time I realized, like, oh, I'm not only am I living in a different world in my life, I'm living in a different world in games.
Everyone I've known throughout my entire life growing up has played video games.
David Brothers is a former comic book journalist who now works at Image Comics. He also started playing video games as a kid. He noticed a lack of diversity that went beyond the male-female divide.
As a kid, pretty much any character who wasn't a white guy, and even a lot of the white guys, were stereotypes. So it led to a situation where, for example, at one point there were more black boxers in fighting games than there were black main characters in every other video game.
David says he thinks video games aren't diverse for a few reasons. One is that companies are hesitant to put out characters from different communities because they're afraid they'll get them wrong. Or that those games just plain won't make money.
If a game comes out and it's got a lady as a hero and then it doesn't sell any copies, they're like, oh, well, it must be because there was a woman and guys don't want to play as women. But women play video games. Like, you know, I grew up playing video games with my cousin and she's definitely a lady.
In fact, it's not just ladies like David's cousin who play video games. A lot of women do. According to the Entertainment Software Rating Board, 40% of gamers are women. Though there are differences of gender, race, and ethnicity, David says there are certain things that we all understand.
Everyone knows what it's like to fear losing a parent or to fear being a bad parent even, or even just waking up and like having a bad day and stubbing your toe and, you know, cussing out an ottoman or something like that. All of our experiences are relatable as long as you deliver them in a way that we can recognize what's going on.
And for him, this is part of the magic of video games.
You're essentially living someone else's story. And this is as true of role-playing games where, you know, you're the hero in a small town and you go out and slay the evil king and become king. Or even sports games. I play a lot of NBA 2K14, which is just NBA basketball. And that's it. You can create a player or you can play as the actual players. Here's Paul. After the made shot from Usher, you can see the eye contact. But while you're playing those games, it's totally a you sink into the game. It becomes your reality.
And sometimes living someone else's story can make you deal with your own.
There is a game called Papa and Yo.
It's Papa y Yo.
But it was created by a developer, and it's essentially about the developer's relationship with his father as a kid. His father was scary and abusive, but also very loving and supportive at the same time.
The game follows a little boy named Kiko and his best friend, Monster. Monster is addicted to frogs, and when he eats them, his personality grows violent and abusive. But Kiko still loves Monster and wants to save him.
I've been playing that game very slowly over the past few years because just the father issues in it are so real and so resonant that it's hard to take for very long. It's fun, it's excellent, but it's harrowing on a very personal level for me. And it's been one of my favorite games just because of that.
That game, Papo Io, was created by this guy.
My name is Vander Caballero. I'm creative director and presidente of Minority Media.
Though he now runs Minority Media in Montreal, Vander grew up in Colombia. He says his hard childhood made video games very important to him. That is, until he hit his teens and found girls.
And then I abandoned games for a bit. And I remember one night I was walking with a girlfriend of mine and we walked in front of Blockbuster and I saw Mario in 64 and suddenly went, wow, that's 3D graphics.
So Vander studied industrial design. There weren't video game programs at the time, though that has changed. He says that while you might not see it reflected in the games, it's not a secret to the companies who's playing the games.
They're really aware, big companies are really aware of who's playing those games.
This awareness even led to work for Vander at some well-known video game companies, like Electronic Arts or EA.
So my first job at EA was working for FIFA.
FIFA, as in football or soccer? The game features real teams and players from around the world.
I was an art director for FIFA, and they were looking for people with that experience from another cultural point of view. And that it was really valuable. So we were a multicultural team when we were working on FIFA, and it was amazing. So we're really aware of who's playing the game, so for who are we building games for.
But not every experience is as multicultural as working on a game about international soccer teams. Take what happened when he worked on the game Army of Two.
There was a moment that we were designing the two characters. A bunch of guys were pushing to be Caucasians, and I said, like, no, if both heroes are Caucasians, I'm leaving. And then I was able to put an immigrant character, Tyson Rios, in the game.
After 8 years working for the big companies, Vander started Minority Media, precisely so he could make games like Papoillo. The game got great reviews. Sometimes Vander hears from fans who, like David, see something of themselves in the game. One day, Vander even got a letter he never expected.
I received a letter from a dad, a single dad, who wrote to me saying, I love Papoillo because when I was playing, I realized how my kid felt when I screamed to him. And then I went, wow. I was not only able to touch the victims, but also the aggressors. I never thought I would be able to touch someone like my father.
And for Vander, that means everything.
It is so beautiful. I think right now as an artist, I could die. I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish.
Vander sees his success as a reason to be hopeful.
I'm the example that is changing, and it could change. We just need more time and more people who have the opportunity to be in position of power, being minorities, to influence the choices.
But getting diverse voices into those positions is a big challenge when people don't feel welcome. Mary Lourdes is a good example.
I mean, everything I hear about women in the industry is that they're not wanted, and it's extremely difficult. And I honestly shied away from it myself. I thought for a while that I was like, oh, well, I love video games. I could turn that into a career, especially like writing-wise. I would love to write video games. But just seeing, and this is kind of a shame because I think the more women involved, the better we would get for all women. But seeing the way women were treated, I was like, you know what? I don't need that. I don't want that part of my life.
It's a treatment that Mary says comes from fear. Not that she herself fully gets that.
I don't understand what the fear is, especially because you want women in your corner. Because those games all the time go to like court cases or they get rulings against them that are like, you have to have labels so kids don't buy it. And who do you want in your corner is women and mothers. You know, I'm going to be a mother someday and I like video games and I'm going to like if my kids play video games. But not if you continually tell me that it's not a space for me.
Yet the online vitriol that so often greets requests for more diverse games proves that the fear is real, at least among some people. But whatever it is, it won't stop everyone from wanting something more. Here's David Brothers again.
Diversity doesn't take anything away. Like, you're not going to not get stories about white dudes anymore. You know, those are still going to exist. You just get those stories plus stories about, I don't know, gay men or Jewish women or First Nations peoples in Canada. You know, there's a lot I don't know. And I'm increasingly okay with that, but there's still a lot that I want to know. And the more people tell their stories, even just around me, like if I trip over a story or I find something, you know, it makes my life better to know what they've gone through as well.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
For more about video games and to check out our other stories in our four-part series on diversity and geekdom, visit latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA,
you can hear like a moment where people don't quite seem to understand what's going on. And then there's a big whoop, which I like to just assume is the Orange is the New Black table.
A chat about a surprise win for representation at this year's Golden Globes. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. What a strange and sad few weeks it's been for the city of New York and for its relationship with the NYPD. Tensions have long been high between New York's finest and communities of color, but they got even higher following the death of Eric Garner, especially after a grand jury chose not to indict the officer who killed him. Dramatic protests filled the streets, and sometimes they insulted the police. Then, in December, things hit a breaking point. A crazed gunman from Baltimore shot and killed two NYPD officers as they sat in a squad car in Brooklyn. The city went on high alert. And then, after sensing a huge rift with Mayor Bill de Blasio, the NYPD began a remarkable work stoppage. The city's largest police union requested that officers only make arrests, quote, when absolutely necessary. So for roughly 2 weeks, arrests were cut by two-thirds, and smaller summonses like traffic and parking violations were virtually non-existent. And yet, despite concerns that without police oversight, the city would erupt into a plume of criminal activity, there was no crime wave. Last week, the work stoppage ended, and arrest rates returned, for better or worse, to normal. But questions remain about what the work stoppage meant and what it says about the role the NYPD plays in the city, as well as what future policing might look like. To help us make sense of it all, I'm joined in the studio by Matt Ford, who is the national editor of The Atlantic. His writing during the work stoppage posed important and challenging questions for all of us. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a simple question. What was the purpose of the NYPD work stoppage? What was the end game?
I don't really know if there was one. The slowdown appears to have been kind of not very well organized, not really well top-down, almost an organic thing. I think that what it did reflect was kind of a broader disengagement or disaffection with the mayor's policies. You certainly see that in what the police union is saying, what cops on the job are saying and telling people in interviews. There's kind of a broader detachment from City Hall that is really being reflected now by this kind of refusal to participate in what many people consider ordinary police activity.
I think a lot of people appreciate the fact that, okay, so now there weren't going to be a lot of these unnecessary arrests. But at the same time, some people might be saying, wow, the NYPD actually is kind of like turning their back on saying, we're not going to look out for you guys. We're not going to look out for your safety. And that feels very confusing, I think, to a lot of people.
That's right. I think, you know, maybe what it is that there's kind of a disconnect between what the public understands the role of police to be and what the role of police actually ideally is or should be or how they perceive it to be. People see arrests as kind of the best benchmark of police activity, but in a way it kind of can be misleading. People make too many arrests, it'll look like crime is going up. People make too few arrests and criminals aren't being caught. It's really not a good barometer. You know, what always has been a better barometer is the level of public comfort. And if that's challenged, you know, either on good basis or bad, that can be a serious problem for community detentions. That can seriously, down the road, affect the NYPD's job. If people, all people, can't trust the NYPD to be there for when they need them, that's a serious issue for a police department.
There was a lot of attention brought to the fact that Mayor de Blasio had a conversation with his son, Dante, basically saying, you've got to be really careful when you're dealing with the NYPD. But I think, you know, if you ask any parent of a child of color, it's a conversation that they've had. But the NYPD did take it really personally.
Well, because the NYPD is fundamentally, you know, a collection of individuals. And none of them probably perceived themselves as being part of a larger problem. they all think, you know, they go to bed thinking, you know, I'm not somebody that, you know, African-American kids, Hispanic kids should fear. But at the same time, we see through statistical evidence, through the disproportionate number of stop and frisks that were conducted, we see through individual cases like Eric Garner and previous cases of police brutality that there is a kind of a valid perception among communities of color that there is something to worry about. That's kind of a bridge that has not really been crossed, or, you know, a divide that hasn't really been bridged.
I mean, the irony, of course, is that it really does reveal how unnecessary some of the NYPD's practices have been. So what in fact are some of the lessons of the stoppage in terms of the excessiveness of the NYPD and its level of arrests?
I think that's a great point. And the thing that we have to take into consideration with this is that on one hand, we haven't learned much. The slowdown was only for 2 weeks. It happened in the winter when crime is typically lower than in the summer. It's not a really good statistical window, and there are a lot of variables that can throw it off to see if there's a larger conclusion to be drawn here. But at the same time, I would assume, and I've assumed throughout all of this, that the NYPD would not actively risk public safety. You know, the question I posed before is, why haven't they been doing this all along? And I think that's where we're really going to be seeing the broader discussion here.
But the NYPD also has to justify the existence, its existence, frankly. It is, you know, in terms of numbers, could be considered the world's seventh largest army.
Right.
I mean, there are some who say, you know, the New York Police Department's industrial complex, right? I mean, they have to support this large institution. So in that sense, how does that play into these arrest numbers?
I think that would have been really interesting to see if it had gone on longer, to see if there would have eventually been a realization that we're not only not proving our point, but we're also disproving our kind of basis. The police unions are constantly saying that they need more officers, that they need more support, that they need more backing, they need more resources and material. And what they've proved is almost the opposite, that New York City can survive for 2 weeks with no major outbreaks of crime, no major breaches of public order, and everything went fine. New York is still standing despite arrests being cut 2/3.
So did the NYPD, in fact, play right into essentially proving what the protesters were asking for, a pullback as necessary?
I think that's absolutely right. You can imagine these protesters, to get a 2/3 cut in NYPD arrests, If that had achieved as a result of the marches directly, if they went and said, you know, because of this, we've heard you, we're cutting arrests by 2/3, that would be seen as a major victory. It would be one of the greatest victories for activists in criminal justice reform in a generation. But it didn't. It happened unintentionally as a side effect of a political gamesmanship, which kind of makes it all the more impressive that they can just almost turn it off like that, rather than having to be the sustained democratic discourse. It can just happen.
Thanks so much for all of your reporting on this, Matt. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Ford is the national editor of The Atlantic. He joined me at Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. We wanted to find out how people in some communities here in New York City felt about the police slowdown. Did they feel it helped or hurt? Or did they even notice it at all? Our producer, Michael Simon Johnson, hit the streets of Washington Heights to talk to residents there.
Basically, what's going to happen now is the community is going to feel the brunt of it. They're going to have to make up them ticket quotas. As we stand here, like every other car, they're stopping here on Amsterdam. So, you know, it's going to go back to the community is going to start having problems with the police again, and it's all because of the brass.
Sorry, what was your name again?
Ray Cintron.
Jose Torres. No, I didn't notice. I didn't notice anything. I kept seeing the sirens going around, them doing their job, stopping people, maybe for red light or broken light or whatever, you know. But to me, it seems like normal.
Quandell Coleman. There's not that many police officers in the train stations as it used to be. And I also noticed a shortage in police patrol. Not only in cars, but also on foot. I haven't been seeing too many cops walk around since then either.
That's all it is. It's a business. New York City is a business. Since the Giuliani administration, they turned this into a business. And the lower class people, like us, the Hispanics and blacks, are the ones that receive the brunt of it.
Yeah.
Most of the things come towards us.
We're only going to start arresting people when it's absolutely necessary. So it's basically like telling on themselves are saying without saying it that, okay, previously before this happened, we've pretty much been arresting people when it really wasn't necessary. So it's sort of like, kind of like abusing your power or your authority.
I'll put it this way. Have you seen the CPR? Courtesy, professionalism, and respect, yeah. They need to implement that.
So you think they...
No, it's just a facade. That's all that is. Nowadays, they just there for the money, not for the career.
They both are safe already. This ain't the 80s. This ain't the Wild West City no more. You know, it's not all that craziness no more. Yeah. Sometimes they make arrests just to make arrests. Sometimes they don't need to talk. They can talk to you. You understand? And play it down. But they got to bring in a quota of arrest. So they're going to arrest you for anything.
They say they don't have a quota.
No, they have a quota. Trust me. They have a quota. Everybody has a quota. I got 9 work orders to do. I got to do that. That's a quota. You got to give me 10 arrests a month. That's a quota.
Okay, from the monetary perspective, I feel like, okay, right there again, it's like they're telling on themselves. Crime pays. You know, so what you have to do is, in order to... because they cut down on ticketing or earning, you know, revenue from tickets, traffic tickets, they need to come up with another solution to make money instead of always trying to figure out how to exploit people to make money. You know, figure out how to, you know, build something else that can help people and make money at the same time. Because if we don't, it's just going to be a continuous vicious cycle where we're trying to exploit people.
As we continue talking about gaming the system, the Hollywood star system isn't exactly known as the most inclusive system of all time, especially when it comes to Latinos. But at this year's Golden Globes, there was a surprise win in the category of Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Comedy.
And the Golden Globe goes to Gina Rodriguez, Jane the Virgin.
Gina Rodriguez walked up to the podium, visibly overwhelmed.
Thank you, God, for making me an artist. I wanted to thank... I want to thank CBS, Leslie Moonves, and David Staff for believing in me. My awesome president at the CW, Mark Pedowitz. You rock. Ben Silverman. Thank you, Jenny Ehrman, for making me your Jane. Thank you to Stephen Foss and the Jane TV, Jane the Virgin cast and crew. Thank you to my entire cast. I am nothing without you. Thank you to my mom and my dad, who are telling me to dream big and to never stop dreaming. To my siblings, to my sister, Evelise and Rebecca, for being the biggest role models in my life. This award is so much more than myself. It represents a culture that wants to see themselves as heroes. My father used to tell me to say every morning, today's going to be a great day, I can and I will. Well, Dad, today's a great day, I can, and I did.
Her win set social media on fire in a good way. So I asked our producer, Daisy Rosario, to join me in the studio to talk about the amazing Gina Rodriguez moment at the Golden Globes. Hey, Daisy.
Hey, Maria. Oh, boy. Did she stick the landing on that acceptance speech?
It was the first thing we talked about on Monday morning.
Absolutely.
Right when we got back. I knew she was going to win. I don't know why. But well, the speech.
You knew, you're saying, but I don't think anybody expected it. It seemed very surprising. I was surprised. And what she talked about in the speech, which, you know, kind of representation stuff, she has talked about this in other interviews. This seems to be something that she's very passionate about. And she expressed it incredibly eloquently in her speech. I mean, she really nailed that speech.
It was clearly very emotional. I mean, she had just won over pretty fabulous actresses, right? But I think it just took it to the next level when she took that pause and said, I'm just speaking about a culture that wants to see ourselves as heroes.
Absolutely. When Gina Rodriguez gets to the part in her speech where she starts talking about representation, you can hear like a moment where people don't quite seem to understand what's going on. And then there's a big whoop, which I like to just assume is the Orange is the New Black table. I like to assume like that table like got it right away and was like, yes, like that. We know what you're talking about, Gina. But there's also a very sweet reaction, you know, the presenters of the award. I know you love Scandal. Kerry Washington was presenting the award.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, they take such quick shots, but there's a shot of Kerry Washington, like, right after it's been said, and she just looks so overjoyed for her. So I think any, you know, artist of color, anyone who hasn't been the mainstream, who hasn't easily fit in, often gets where these things are coming from, you know? I mean, there's a lot of times we talk about things like this and we'll get into the haters on Twitter, and I think they're inevitable, but this was kind of the rare time where you got to just see people go, rah, rah, yay, I'm so excited and surprised by this.
And she was able to mention her sisters, her mom, her dad. But you know what I loved also, Daisy, was to see her there take that breath, just kind of like go into a, okay, let me calm down and get this together. I mean, it was almost like a metaphor for all of us who are challenged, facing all kinds of issues at any moment. And then we're just like, okay, take a breath. I mean, in so many ways, it's like for Latinas, it's like, yeah, that's how we do it. That's how we roll.
Well, you want to enjoy it and you also don't want to like miss the opportunity. So I think that was what was so impressive as she was, you know, I was sitting watching the Golden Globes also putting together a Lego kit because I like to keep busy. And, you know, so I'm kind of watching them and half tuning in depending on the category. And, you know, so I'm listening to these people being announced. I'm not expecting her to win. I hear her name and I'm like, whoa, I, you know, look up and I'm listening to the speech. And, you know, not only was it beautifully delivered and she got it at the end, but she really hit all the points she wanted. And I mean, if you want to joke about it, yeah, she really got in depth on the family, which was very sweet. And, you know, as some would say, very Latino.
Very Latino. Well, and by the way, not that we talk fashion a lot, but that dress was pretty fabulous, too.
She looked
She looked
great.
Pretty fabulous.
I know.
Okay. It's great talking to you about the Golden Globes, Daisy.
Thanks, Maria.
Latino USA producer, Daisy Rosario. Coming up on Latino USA,
a lot of our major scientists here in the United States are immigrants.
The undocumented public school kids who beat MIT in a robotics competition. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Un fugitivo de la humanidad, antisocial, que nunca sabe de qué tema.
Blanca en lo alto del cerro. Lo que está de planta le tocaban a mi abuelo. Venido del oriente, de raza de vivente. Por eso me enseñaba que los jardines amaban. De mi mano nacía la flor que allá vino. Con la rima de pena alimentada de esquina. Con el mugo de ave tejía mi vestido. Los labios me pintaba con jodil petro vestido. El legado de mi abuelo se expandió en el hemisferio. Y puso cuatro covines, hay oferta de jardines.
Bye.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In 2004, a public high school robotics team in Arizona entered an underwater robotics competition that pitted them against elite colleges, including MIT. All the team members were undocumented, and many of them were poor. Their story went on to inspire a book, a documentary, and even a movie. It's called Spare Parts. Two of the original team members tell us about the experience that changed their lives forever.
I was a on-hands type of guy
that I've always liked, you know, doing stuff with my hands, building, creating.
Hi, my name is Lorenzo Santillan.
My name is Christian Arcega.
And I was a part of the Falcon Robotics team.
I am one of the original members from the Spare Parts movie.
I was brought over from Mexico when I was 9 months old. I grew up here in the Phoenix metro area all my life.
I grew up in Mexicali, Baja California, in Mexico, up until I was about 6 years old, and I've lived in this area ever since. I'm here in Phoenix.
So my cousin had a repair shop. He would work out of the house. I would just tag along and help out or do whatever he needed me to do. Or when he went to the auto parts place, I would just sit outside and watch his tools and stuff.
Since I was in kindergarten, my mom said she has this letter of me saying that I want to, you know, when I grow up, I want to build robots. And I ended up finding that at Carleton High School. I mean, I was kind of bored in class.
There was a robotics team on campus. So I was like, well, I'll just go look at it and see what it's like. There was tools and I could break things. It was the first year that we entered the underwater robotics competition.
The Marine Advanced Technology Education, the, you know, 2004 MATE ROV competition.
We worked on a robot for about 4 to 5 months.
I mean, we all expected we were going to, you know, be outclassed. Our robot was made out of PVC. Everybody else's was made out of metal. We used trolling motors used for fishing boats.
In the competition, the robot was supposed to do surveillance, bring up a captain's bell, take a temperature, bring up a liquid, and that was the one that was the hardest.
Some of the things you come across when you're building a robot, like very, very cheaply, is you don't have a lot of the access to materials you would like.
We had a leak.
Our underwater case ended up leaking because it was discontinued because it was leaking, and that's why we got it on sale.
We had to repair it or fix it.
So we were thinking, you know, what's small, what's absorbent.
One of us said tampons.
Yeah, you know, that would probably work.
Everybody said, oh, no, I'm not going to go get them.
Not it.
It just trickled down to me being it, the one that's going to go buy them.
So we ended up third place overall in the underwater robot mission. I mean, we were like over the moon about that. I mean, we were third place. We were expecting, you know, as long as we don't finish last, you know, we can brag we beat one school. And then we get to the actual award ceremony on the last day. They start announcing the awards, and the first one they announce is a special award that they made up just for that competition on the spot. And this award was for ingenuity, blah, blah, blah. You know, figured, oh, Carleton High School wins. And we're like, oh, man, we probably got the pity award because, you know, we did pretty bad and everything else or something. They started announcing the big awards, and they announced, you know, the technical writing award. And we won the award, kind of taken back about that. You know, we competed against these other colleges. They started announcing the awards, you know, third place, Cape Fear Community College. And, you know, we're kind of bummed out. We thought, hey, maybe we got second, or, you know, we ended up fourth, which was more probable. And, you know, they announced second place, MIT. Now we're really bummed out, and we're also really, really, you know, kind of nervous because it's possible we did really, really, really bad, or it's possible we got first place. And all of us are really quiet. So then they start, you know, doing the drum roll, and then they say first place, Carl Haight. And at that moment, the whole room just went crazy.
In my own experience, I didn't know how it felt like to win because I had never won anything in my life. Maybe a few certificates of like student of the month or whatever, but like nothing real big in a competition. And what I really remember is that they told us who MIT was and who all these, you know, prestigious colleges and universities were, but that wasn't the purpose that we were there to beat them at all. It was to learn.
When I graduated from high school, I graduated second in my class. With how well I did, I got the presidential scholarship that it was called at the time. And, you know, that paid for my full tuition for 4 years at a local university. And I went to ASU for about a year, and then Prop 300 came into effect. And that denied any kind of financial aid or assistance to undocumented students in Arizona. They revoked my scholarship for being undocumented.
And I actually went into culinary arts in a community college here in Arizona.
I still don't have anywhere close to being able to get my degree in engineering.
A lot of our major scientists here in the United States are immigrants. Albert Einstein was an immigrant as well, so.
Right now, I'm doing a crowdfunding campaign so I can go back to school in the fall. It's collegestream.help, and I'm trying to raise funds so I can go back to college this fall.
We're trying to get an education. We're trying to, you know, make our own businesses or be scientists. At the same time, our own government here in the United States is pushing us away. After 27 years of living here in the United States, I'm not able to have citizenship.
There's a lot of reasons why people enjoy certain, you know, parts. You know, some people like math, some people don't like it, some people like reading, some others don't. The advice I would have is that if you're staying away from, you know, these kinds of technology fields, it has to be because you've already come to terms with the fact that it's not for you. It can't be a reason that, you know, it's too hard or, you know, it doesn't really fit you. It has to be a conscious decision that you want to pursue something else.
I know that there's other immigrant youth and dreamers that will probably benefit from our story, that we share the same stories. I mean, they just weren't able to share it as big as we have, basically.
That was Lorenzo Santillan and Cristian Arcega, two of the members of the Carl Hayden Community High School robotics team of 2004. Spare Parts, the movie inspired by their story, is in theaters now. And now, a garden in a distressed neighborhood in southwestern Pennsylvania. Kids there have been growing food, gaining digital literacy, and building community all at the same time. Erica Barras takes us to Garduino.
Yay!
It'll probably take some time to plan, though.
Who knew that if you squeeze a tomato, it'll make music? Okay, this won't happen with any tomato. It has to be a tomato in a community garden in North Braddock, Pennsylvania. And it has to be hooked up to a device called an Arduino, a microcontroller with sensors. An Arduino is like a mini computer. Except a computer is a closed system, already programmed. An Arduino is open. It does what you tell it to do, like converting the touch of a tomato to a musical note.
And so what it does is that you're sending just a signal to G, the letter G, that controls the keyboard. G, the keyboard.
That's Kelvin Rojas, who's leading a technology workshop for a bunch of kids gathered around a wooden table. On the table is the Arduino, attached to a laptop. Wires or circuits sticking out from the Arduino are clamped onto cherry tomatoes. When the kids squeeze those tomatoes, musical notes play.
It's like made of, it's a metal, right?
Who's playing?
Kelvin says this same technology that can make vegetables into piano keys can also be used to collect garden data, like testing humidity in the soil or taking measurements of rain. A garden that uses an Arduino. It's a Garduino, and it's the brainchild of Zaina Ruiz, an artist in North Braddock who wanted to provide a different experience for local kids.
We were hoping to introduce the exposure to the programming part and, like, introduce sensors that are hooked up to Arduinos, and they can collect data and be these little researchers and little scientists.
With another artist friend, Zaina asked the borough to use some of the empty house lots that abound in their community. They got a grant for the Arduino. Then they just showed up. And so did the kids and some of their parents.
Hi.
Hi, Jason.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good.
While Kelvin teaches the kids the basics of computer processing, Zaina helps others put seeds in the ground, water plants, and rip out weeds.
It will actually come out.
Okay.
They put it over here.
We're growing tomatoes, basil, greens, cucumbers. We had cucumbers, lots of peppers, dill, a variety of herbs.
Zaina, a Texan, didn't garden as a child, but her relatives did.
I used to go to Mexico like every summer, if not more, and like spend those 2 months down there. It was a rancho, so it was like just sandy, but there were avocado trees, mango trees, cacti, chickens running around. Back then they didn't even have indoor plumbing, so it was just a whole different lifestyle over there, and I loved going there and, you know, experiencing that.
Now she lives in North Braddock, where more than half the children live below the poverty line. The town never recovered when steel mills shuttered more than a generation ago. Empty lots and boarded up houses abound. Expectations are low and apathy is high.
That opens the door for violence to happen, for kids to run around and do nothing.
That's Jason Ziegler, who's here with his 6-year-old son.
Break in people's house, smoke weed, sell drugs, rob people, get young girls pregnant. I mean, it's just poverty, you know, and that's why, because we ain't got nothing here in Braddock to do, the kids turn to violence and turn to what exception.
Jason is a former gang member himself. Now he's trying to set a good example as a parent. Today, Zaina, Jason, his son, and some other kids are laying grass clippings around some asparagus and mint.
Yeah, so it's a mulch, and when the winter comes, we'll just cover the plants with the mulch, and hopefully it'll protect them.
Yep. Stop being so cold.
Yeah. I'm making a nice warm bed for them.
Because we don't want our plants to die. Yeah. We want them to live.
Jason and those kids are regulars. So is 11-year-old Latea Hux. She points to some of those musical tomatoes.
This one is the ripest one, and then the rest are still green.
Before this summer, Latea had never planted food. Now she knows every nook and cranny of the garden.
These are ground cherries. Well, you know they're good when they are, well, some of them is brighter than this. Some of them's orange. If they're green, they're not ripe yet. Yeah, wait until they fall off the branches.
Next season, Zaina hopes they'll have gardening down and be able to move on to the next levels of digital literacy and farming. That's what Kelvin Rojas is looking to do.
So I was telling my brother about my project out here, and he was really excited for me because we were like the nerdy kids on the block, you know? So my brother said is that it's great to teach electronics to kids out here in Braddock because, you know, electronics are just not for nerdy white kids. It's for everybody.
Watch out, Soso. Be mindful of where you're...
In the meantime, Zaina hopes they provided enough excitement to keep the kids coming back after the winter, just like a perennial plant. For Latino USA, I'm Erica Barris in North Braddock, Pennsylvania.
And now, mis queridos listeners, we're going to end our show with a remembrance of one Latina who, de verdad, played the system for what it was worth. And she left us much too soon. Michelle Cerros's irreverent take on Chicanahood burst onto the scene in the 90s with her book, Chicana Falsa. We could go on about her brilliance, her attitude, her spirit, her laughter, her core. But we figured, why not just play you one of her stories, read by Michelle Cerros herself.
Hollywood Park. Del Mar was always too far. Kentucky and Belmont states, just satellite fantasies. So Sunday mornings, my father and I piled into Uncle Ricky's Skylark. Exhaust pipe popping, and static bouncing off the interior while we coasted down the 101 to Hollywood Park, the eye of that urban hurricane, tagged Inglewood. I ditched the sandwiches Mama slapped together, filled up on fancy soft serve, wilted footlong dogs that drooped out of hard buns. Uncle Ricky used to say that only fools gambled their fortunes on favorite fat trainers, or picked numbers that added up to nada. Me, I was shown to put money on the glossy asses of young fillies, ones with glistening horse nalgas whipped into shape with patient commands. Go girl, faster, again. Unlike booties drenched in beaten sweat, a glimmering ass was a winning ticket. ...1050 South Prairie, racetrack. Turf Club whites slung gin and tonic high above blacks who spat anger on gray asphalt. Mexicans counted losses in the lower grandstand shade, where we sat. Because my father, well, he was never a fan of the sun who made unwelcome appearances. Every childhood summer, he stretched in Delano orchards. And only because my share doll needed new get-ups, I combed the stadium floor, searched for lost tickets, any meager payback to showplace or win a chance in the winner's circle, where green wreath chokers hung from those whose eyes begged for any nibble of freedom.
That was Michelle Cerros reading her short story, Hollywood Park. She died earlier this month of cancer at the age of 48 at her home in Berkeley, California. Thank you, Michelle, for your sabiduría. And whether you meant to be or not, you have truly become una Chicana role model. And, my dear listeners, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Robert Frazier and Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, I'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org.
I had two Pop-Tarts. It was not the breakfast of champions.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.